What's ahead for our property markets? If you're curious what will affect our property markets in 2022, you're going to love today's show because Pete Borgent and I are going to discuss eight trends that will shape our housing markets in the future. Now, today's show is actually an episode of Pete Borgent's Property Pod, but after our conversation, where together we shared what I believe was some great information, including where to buy property in 2022 and what types of property to buy, I asked Pete for permission to replay this show to you, to my audience, and I'm sure you're going to get great benefit wherever you are on your property journey. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
G'day, welcome to the Pete Borgent Property Pod. So this week I've got a familiar guest back on the show, Mr. Michael Yardney, joining us from Melbourne. Michael, great to have you on.
Thanks, Pete.
Now, I think most listeners would be familiar with your background, but why don't you give us a bit of an overview? I usually do these intros myself, but who better than you to give people an overview of your 40 years in property?
Well, it's actually probably almost five decades of property now. And so I started when I was young and I've turned 69. So it's easy for me to have close to a five-year history of property investing. So I've been around a long time. I've seen the cycles. And for the last 20-odd years or so, I've been helping educate people and give strategic property advice. So I've got a podcast and a blog and Metropole Properties that helps clients. And so I look forward today to maybe having a bit of a chat about what we can look forward to next year in property.
Yeah, so that's particularly why I wanted to get you on the show again, because I've been to many of your seminars over the years. And one of the things I always noticed...
I don't do those anymore, Pete. I can't.
Well, yes, I guess these days everyone's gone to webinars because of the restrictions. But I remember going to one of your seminars, maybe it must have been around 2004, 2005 at City Tats in Sydney. And one of the things that always makes me chuckle is that people will listen to the advice on tax and how to set up a trust and structure and all this other stuff. And then as soon as you talk about which suburbs you're likely to buy in, which is going to be the best performing city, suddenly everyone grabs their pen and springs to life and starts scribbling down notes. So I thought, well, learning from that, it would be great to actually tap into a couple of things. Firstly, what property trends you foresee for 2022. And secondly, I think a really interesting thing to cover off would be if you have a provisional, let's say $1 million to invest in property, where would you invest that money today? And we can go around the traps and look at some options. So let's start with the first one. Property trends for the new year. What do you think will be some of the big things to look out for?
Sure. Well, if we put it in context, we've really had a wild ride in property in 2021. So I believe what's going to happen next year is overall, the property markets are going to slow down. But at the end of 2022, property values will still overall be maybe 6 to 8% higher, with some markets performing better than others. But I also have learned by doing this for so long that despite the best predictions, if history taught me anything, is that there's going to be an unexpected effect. An X factor coming out of the blue that's going to make all those forecasts that you and I are going to talk about now change, either on the upside or the downside. There was COVID a couple of years ago. There was the Delta strain of COVID last year that closed big capital cities down for a while. So with that disclaimer, I think the first trend is that property values are still going to go up, Pete, but they're going to go up at a slower rate. The leading indicators I look at are things like housing finance. And even though they've dropped a little bit recently, one of the changes, Pete, of course, has been that investors are back in the market again now, aren't they?
Yes. And in fact, the time of recording, the ABS just put out its latest figures. And there has actually been a bit of a fall in the number of home buyers in the market, probably driven to some extent by the lockdowns in Sydney and Melbourne, because these figures are always backwards looking. But investor lending is now on the up. And I think one of the things that has become clear over the past 15 or 20 years is when investors are coming into the market tends to rise. They tend to sort of amplify the cycle. So yes, definitely investors coming back. And I'm sure you've seen that at Metropole, more inquiries and so on.
More than ever. So most investors get it wrong because they come in at the end of the cycle when for a year they've heard in the media that auction clearance rates are high and property values are high and now rentals are going up. So I believe that we're going to also move into a two-tier property market moving forward. So while property markets have performed well so far, I think moving forward, affordability issues are going to constrain many buyers. Pete, the impetus of the low interest rates to allow borrowers to borrow more has worked its way through the system. So at the end of this cycle, I can see that property values are going to be, well, 25, 30% higher than at the beginning of the cycle. And in some areas, they're already that much. But that means the average Australian buyer, they haven't got enough money, more money in their pockets to be able to pay more. So that's one of the reasons property markets are going to slow down. But I also see it's one of the reasons we're going to have a two-tier market moving forward, because while the average Aussie worker hasn't got more money to keep paying more, they can't go to the bank and ask for more, and interest rates aren't lowering to give them more borrowing capacity, there are some people, the knowledge workers and those who already have assets. Their assets are going up in value, their rents are going up, their share dividends are coming back, their businesses are performing better. So it's going to create more of a split between the haves and the have-nots. I guess you're noticing that as well.
Yes, I mean, I always follow with interest the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Report. And even since the last one was released, Australian household wealth has come storming higher, not just property, since superannuation balances on the rise. And look, there's always tricks and nuances about how these things are measured. Some countries don't have the equivalent of superannuation and so on, but pretty much any way you cut it, Australia's right up near the top of the list. I think there are more millionaires in America, but actually, household wealth in Australia per capita is extremely high. A very successful period, really, since the start of the mining boom. The superannuation guarantee has been a part of that. So has property. Stock market's done well. And household wealth at over $10 trillion now. So there'll be some parts of the country where that wealth is concentrated, not necessarily spread around evenly, though.
Sure. So we are a millionaire factory. We've become that way. And the suggestion from various reports is that we're going to create 50% more millionaires over the next 5 years. And in general, that's related to the assets that they own. It's not the income they've earned, Pete. It's not what they've saved. I think one of the other reasons our property markets are going to slow down over the next year is because pent-up demand is waning. We've sort of worked our way through the cycle. And we also know that APRA is intent on slowing our markets with macro-prudential controls. So if they don't slow naturally, as they're starting to anyway, APRA is going to intervene a bit more. But in other words, not all locations are going to grow as strongly moving forward. That's what I'm getting at when I'm saying a two-tier market. So I can see properties located in the middle ring suburbs, particularly the gentrifying locations, they're going to outperform the cheaper outer suburbs, which interestingly is where the market started performing well at the beginning of 2020 and then 2021. This cycle started working in all around Australia, in regional Australia, and particularly in the lower priced suburbs. But they've become unaffordable for the people who are there, for many young families and first home buyers. I think more than that, though, COVID's actually adversely affected the lower income earners to a greater extent than it has the higher income earners, which is creating a bit of a disparity socially. And that's a bit of a concern.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, when you look at some of the sectors like hospitality and tourism and some of those traditionally less well-paid occupations, they've actually been hit harder. Now, the government's done the right thing and put in place stimulus packages, but for sure, the recovery is not going to be even. And I think, as you mentioned there, actually, some of the sort of more affordable fringe suburbs have really seen prices surging. And I guess it might have started out because of a combination of affordability and also people seeking more space, you know, getting away from sort of the dense high-rise towers where they couldn't use the lift or the gym or the pool and all of that stuff. So it kind of had some logic, but I think in some cases, actually, prices have got ahead of themselves, and the same in some regions as well, I guess.
Yes, I'd agree with that. Look, I think as we start to emerge from COVID, there is going to now be a flight to quality of properties. FOMO led a lot of people over the last year or so to cutting corners, to buying secondary properties, to buying properties on main roads or properties that won't serve them well moving forward. But if our markets cool down a bit, as I can imagine they're going to in 2022, there'll be more time to make decisions. Of course, a new wave of investors are coming into the market, as we've said, and they're not as educated as those who've lived through a couple of cycles. So they're bound to make the same mistakes that others have done in the past. So another trend for 2022 is some investors are going to get burned because they're not going to get the right advice to start with. They're not going to start with a plan. They're not going to have a buyer's agent on their side leveling the playing field. They're going to go to the property marketers or the off-the-plan people, the house and land packages. So I guess some are going to get burned. That's just the way the cycle moves, isn't it, Pete?
Oh, yeah. And when I mentioned coming to your seminars, that's exactly why I used to come because, you know, a lot of stuff, when you've been in the market for a few cycles, a lot of things seem very obvious to you. But it's easy to forget. Like when you started out, when you were younger, we didn't know a lot of stuff. And in fact, back in those days, there were far fewer books and resources and places to learn. And there was a lot of people trying to sell you stuff, particularly, as you mentioned, house and land packages and off-the-plan units in far-flung locations. When you get into a rising market, people tend to get a fear of missing out and they get a bit complacent. And that's really when people make the bigger mistakes. And I think I would have to check the history books. Was it Napoleon who said that the time of greatest risk is at the period of victory because people let their guard down? I think it's exactly the same in financial markets.
Oh, people get carried away. Fear and greed kick in because we're human. And as we said, the new naive property investors, and we all started that way, so it's not disparaging them. They just believe what they're told, and that's a pity. Look, as we talk about trends for 2022, I think our economy is going to pick up. We've spoken about that concept before for a number of reasons. At the same time, households have squirreled away an estimated $200 billion this year with the prolonged lockdowns, particularly in our larger cities. So as life gets back to normal, we're going to start spending some of that. So we're going to pay down some debt. We're going to buy assets. We're going to treat ourselves because we feel we deserve it. But it's also been apparent in the property markets, home buyers upgrading, home buyers renovating, and others have actually just bought a holiday home because they haven't been able to go overseas, Pete.
Yes, I mean, it's the cash levels were already pretty high in Australia. I think there's something that's been quite uniquely Australian is the building up of these big offset accounts and mortgage buffers, effectively prepaying the mortgage. Very Australian trend. So I think the household liquidity was already very good, but the last year, 18 months, as you mentioned, hundreds of billions of excess household savings piling up there. I think in the third quarter, because of the Sydney and Melbourne lockdowns, household saving ratio was near enough 20%. I mean, we just don't see numbers like that in recent decades. There's a lot of cash on the sidelines there. And when people are able to get out and spend again, I think they'll do so with gusto. Because I think a lot of people aren't quite ready to travel overseas yet. Too many COVID restrictions, too much uncertainty, flights are expensive. So I think a lot of those dollars will find their way back into the Aussie economy next year.
What I've noticed planning our Christmas holidays is accommodation is expensive, restaurants are expensive, life has become more expensive. I think some organisations are making up for their losses over the last year or two, and I don't begrudge them doing that. Now, moving forward and looking for further trends, I believe the official interest rate is going to remain unchanged next year. Now, I know there's a lot of people who I believe are better educated than me and smarter than me that would disagree, but in my mind, the official Reserve Bank interest rates likely to remain unchanged in 2022 because I can still see our economy operating below its potential with economic growth and wages growth at the moment not strong enough to justify an interest rate rise. Remember, the current rates are stimulatory. The Reserve Bank's only going to raise interest rates when it's done its job, when the low interest rates have done their job of boosting the economy, when the economy's bounding along and when wages growth have remained higher, stronger for some time. And I know there's currently jobs growth occurring, unemployment's falling. Well, it's crept up a bit, but it's likely to fall again. There's rises in full-time jobs. But there's also those 200,000 more skilled immigrants coming or plan to be coming to Australia, and this would fill some of those job vacancies. That's going to dampen wages growth as well. But Pete, I wouldn't be surprised over the next year if banks keep rising their interest rates out of cycle, as they've already started to do with the fixed rates, with the longer term rates, because their cost of funds is starting to creep up a bit, Pete.
Yeah, I think, I mean, people can spend an awful lot of time trying to second guess what interest rates are going to do. I think, as you said, there's a lot of excitement in commentary about the Australia's three-year bond yield suddenly jumping higher as the Reserve Bank, I guess, kind of miscommunicated its role in the market there. But the bigger picture for people interested in property is, mortgage rates might creep higher from the lowest level in history, but take a look at 4, 5, 10-year bond yields. We're not going to see high interest rates. I think this is an important distinction. We've got the cash rate at zero effectively at the moment at the lower bound. Look, it might creep higher 2022, back end of 22, early 23. But, you know, if the cash rate goes from zero to one, you know, it's not really going to move the needle that much. And I think that's the big picture that sometimes people miss.
One of the other trends I'm foreseeing in 2022 is APRA is likely to tighten its macroprudential measures. APRA's really only tapped its foot on the brake pedal, Pete. It hasn't really pushed it down hard. It actually hasn't tried to slow our markets. So if the property markets continue to grow too fast for their liking, we're not totally sure what their liking is. They're likely to reduce stricter measures. But Pete, hopefully they've actually learned the lessons from their past mistakes. I well remember what happened in 2017-18 under their watch, when the stricter bank lending criteria that they instigated, it actually created a credit squeeze that just didn't slow the market. It actually stifled certain markets. Now, by the way, they were right to do it when in 2016, more than half the properties bought in Sydney were by investors. The market was overheated, but I think they went a bit too far.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's easy to forget the chronology when you're looking back, but there was also a banking royal commission that the government was basically pressurized into holding. And I mean, that just created so much fear among brokers and lenders, because there was just no clarity or certainty about what they were supposed to be doing. There was people checking receipts for $10 payments and $5 standing orders. It was just crazy stuff. So I don't think we'll see an equivalent this time around. We might see, as you mentioned, if investor lending gets too hot, then APRA now does have the tools ready to get banks to actually implement them in a timely manner if needed. But I don't think they'll be going in wholesale with hard tightening rules. I think, if anything, they would like to see the market cool naturally as new listings come online. And I think that's probably what will happen.
Neither APRA nor the Reserve Bank want the property markets to crash. I guess they want that, Pete, as much as they want another strain of the coronavirus. I think one of the other trends that's going to happen over the next year is property investors are going to return. We've already suggested that with finance pre-approvals, it looks like property investors are already now getting back into the market, but they're still well below the long-term average levels, where about a third of properties are bought by investors. So this cycle was initially driven by owner-occupiers, upgrading, and first home buyers. But the incentive for first home buyers has now decreased. A lot of those incentives are gone. And we've actually brought forward first home buyer demand. So I can see fewer first home buyers in the market over the next year.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think the first home loan deposit scheme was very successful. And I don't think I've seen this reported anywhere in the media, but home ownership rates have actually been rising through the pandemic. You don't hear that reported, but that is the case, as the first home buyer stimulus kicked in. And now that's going to wash through. So I think the first home buyer numbers will go back towards normal next year. You know, some people are calling for measures to restrict investors, and yet we've got rental vacancies. Well, they're the lowest we've seen in years, probably 10 or 12 years. And there are some rental vacancies in the sort of CBD high-rise towers, but it go around the country. There's chronic rental shortages. So I just don't get the logic myself in terms of restricting investors. If anything, we need more, not fewer.
Well, somebody's got to provide the housing for that third of the community that wants to rent. Now, there's no doubt that we've got to provide social housing for the disenfranchised. There'll always be people who are going to need that, and I believe that's the government's job. Now, whose job is it to provide rental accommodation? For those who are at various stages of their life, they're not ready to buy yet, or they're transitioning, or they're going through divorce, or they're moving to a new state. Somebody's got to provide that. The government isn't. There will eventually be these new built-to-rent complexes. That'll be an interesting change to the rental landscape moving forward. But at the moment, it's really in the hands of private investors who are running their own little small businesses, people like you and me, Pete.
Yeah, they've done a lot of built-to-rent in London. I have to say, I'm not a fan. Often left-leaning people think they're going to be some kind of fix-all solution. But you've got to remember, in the end, big corporations want to make a profit. That doesn't really motivate people to put in place timely repairs or look after buildings. Yet some very generic complexes being built. And the longer term leases can be good for security of tenure. But the trouble is, once you're in the system, you're just another number. Dare I say it, I think in some cases they could be slums of the future. I think private landlords are they're an absolutely key part of the Australian housing market, because the government just doesn't own much of the housing stock. The public sector share is just falling and falling.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way our system works in Australia as opposed to overseas. Okay, Pete, can I share one more trend, one that I can guarantee will happen, Pete?
Please do.
Property pessimists are still going to be out there telling us not to invest, and they're going to tell us that our property markets are going to crash. And why can I guarantee that, Pete? Because that's been the case for the last few decades. But one last guarantee, they're going to be wrong also.
That was probably the easiest prediction because, I first lived in Sydney before the Sydney Olympics, and I remember the Sydney housing market had a good run post-Olympics, and it was just non-stop property bubble talk. And for sure, the market peaked out, but who wouldn't like to go back and buy Sydney property at 2003 prices? Even at the peak of the market, you'd have done very well. Yeah, I think that's an easy prediction to make. So for those of you sitting eagerly at home with your pen in hand, ready to scribble down where to invest in property next year, now is your golden moment, because I'm going to put Michael on the spot. So, Michael, if you had, let's say, $1 million to invest in property, what would you buy if you were looking in, say, Melbourne, which is your local market, of course? And then we might just ask you as well about potentially Sydney and Brisbane.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you, Pete, and I'm going to disappoint the listeners initially, because it's the wrong place to start. Now, I find most property investors start their journey by trying to choose a top location because they think that's the best place to buy an investment, or they look for what the right property is. However, when you look at the result of most property investors, what they achieve, we know it makes little sense to do it the way they do or ask the questions they're asking, because statistics show that 50% of all property investors, well, they sell up in the first 5 years. And of those who stay in the market, we know that 92% never get past their first or second property. So if you want to outperform the average investor, if you want to develop financial freedom, don't start by selecting a location or looking for that ideal property, because property investment's a process, Pete. You know that, and I know that. So I know you're being a good journalist asking me a question that your listeners want, and that's good, and we will get to that. But if I taught you where to fish rather than how to fish, Pete, that probably isn't going to serve the purpose well. So I believe things have got to be done in the right order, and selecting the property comes right at the end of the process. And I know you do that in your own business also, where you actually put a plan together for your clients with buyers, just like we do at Metropole, that for many people, putting a plan there, and the property you eventually buy will be the result of a sequence of questions that you're going to need to ask and answer, and a series of decisions that you're going to need to make even before you start looking at the locations. So long before we talk about property or the right location, at Metropole, we look at a whole lot of factors, including what's your age, what's your time frame, what's the desired results you want, what do you really want your property to do? Are you looking for cash flow? Are you looking for capital growth? Are you looking for a combination of both? Because if I just tell you what to buy in Brisbane or Melbourne or Sydney for $1 million, Pete, what works for me may work for you because you're a very established investor and you've got a big asset base, but it may not work for some of our listeners, and then they're going to wonder, hey, why hasn't it worked? So it really all has to do with a plan and understanding what your finance capacity is, and having a plan will actually help you define your goals. But then when you're going to talk about where to buy and what to buy, I think there are three things you fiddle with: budget, And that's usually determined by the banks. Location, and yeah, I will give you something, Pete, but give me a moment. And then the right property in that location. As we said, I think we're going to be moving into a two-tier property market. So we've got to look at the locations that moving forward, as we move out of COVID, as next, the year after next, we're going to maybe have a bit of a slower property market. We actually have to look at a location that's going to have the right demographic that's going to be able to afford to and prepared to pay more moving forward. So I think the first thing is to actually understand where not to buy. Some people are going to say, I only want to buy in my own backyard. Now, I know you and I don't necessarily agree with that principle. We're borderless investors, but some people are going to suggest, look, I only want to buy in my home state. But I'd be suggesting to people, don't fight the gorillas, the big trends moving forward as our economy picks up and wages growth picks up. Looking in the rear vision mirror of what's happened in the past won't work as well as what's going to create capital growth, if that's your investment philosophy, which happens to be mine. And that actually is jobs growth, which is going to be related to economics growth, but higher waging jobs, skill level one and two jobs, find locations where people have got higher income because they're the areas where properties are going to increase in value. Can I maybe make a suggestion? When we talk about suburbs, Pete, in my mind, there are four different types of suburbs. Can I share those with you?
Please do. I'd love to hear your thought processes.
Well, first of all, there's discretionary locations. They're the more expensive suburbs. So in Sydney, $1 million is not going to get you into those discretionary expensive locations. That's where the established money is. You won't even be able to buy an apartment in Sydney for $1 million in those sort of locations. But that's the area where residents, they've lived for a long time. They've got no debt or 50% debt. There are areas where there's a high percentage of owner-occupiers, but of course, not everyone can afford to buy at that end of the market. So the next level down of suburbs strategic investors look at is what I'd call aspirational locations. They're the upper middle class gentrifying locations, the suburbs where many of the affluent millennials are now aspiring to move because they're moving out of apartments, they're entering their family formation age. These are often the gentrifying suburbs. And people are going to be paying a premium to live in these. And even within these suburbs, you would invest everywhere within the same suburb. People know it themselves. They've got their, in their own suburb, there's areas where they'd live and areas where they wouldn't. And in the post-COVID world, the COVID normal world, as we call it, I think people are going to pay a premium to be in that 20-minute neighborhood where they can, I don't know, drive, ride, walk from home to shopping, to services, to education, to community facilities, to recreation, to gyms, sporting facilities. So I would be investing in either the discretionary suburbs, if you can afford, or the aspirational locations, because there are two other types of suburbs, and they're what I'd be calling the affordable suburbs, and that's where most investors want to invest. In other words, they're told to buy around median price brackets where people can afford, but we've already a couple of times mentioned there's going to be a two-tier property market moving forward, and I think moving forward, the affordable areas where people are already maxed out because their wages haven't gone up as much as property values have, they're going to underperform. And then there's the last choice locations. In every city, there are suburbs where people live because they've got no choice. So people don't wake up in the morning wanting to live in the affordable locations or the last choice locations. So before we even give you a list of suburbs, what I'm suggesting is we actually recognize that they're not all the same. And if you can afford to, then you actually buy in the desirable or the aspirational suburbs and avoid the affordable and the poor suburbs. But even within those suburbs, there's going to be A-grade properties, investment-grade properties. There's going to be B-grade properties that are probably not going to have all the attributes of an A-grade property, or the location's not going to be as good, and then the C-grade properties. So that's the big picture of where we start and look. And so if you're going to buy in whichever state around Australia, don't buy at the lower end. So if your budget doesn't allow you to buy in $1 million in Sydney in a great location, all you could buy is a double garage, maybe you should be looking at Brisbane, where that would buy you well above the median price, Pete.
Yes, yeah. Well, gosh, there's lots to absorb there. I'm just thinking of my own sort of property journey and life in Sydney. I used to live like almost every pom on the planet. I used to live in Bondi. In fact, I bought my first property in Australia in Bondi many years ago. And I used to sort of have it in my head that, well, you know, nobody really wants to live to the west of the CBD, certainly not in my sort of social circle. But then one by one, they nearly all moved over. They went to Newtown, they went to Marrickville, to Erskineville. So I guess those were the big sort of gentrifying inner west suburbs. There was also places like Maroubra and Matraville in the east. And, you know, the results from those suburbs have been very, very good over the years as they've become more desirable. As you mentioned, still very, very easy to get into the CBD or go to the beach, or you can access everything within 10, 15 minutes. And I guess that's the real secret.
Well, I remember when we opened our office in Sydney in 2008 and I drove to those inner western suburbs, you could buy a two-bedroom apartment in Marrickville for $280,000, Pete. And we did buy a lot for our clients then. And today, you wouldn't get much change from $1 million, would you?
Sadly, no. I guess this is why it's always important to stay on top of the trends because, you can make some serious returns. And, you know, for less experienced property investors, you know, what does that kind of mean? Because there's a lot of debate about, you know, is property better or is shares better? I think one of the things that always appealed to me when I was younger was, well, you know, let's say that example property at 280,000, you might have been putting in a deposit of, you know, for the sake of argument, 30,000 plus some closing costs. But look at the equity you've created over the years, you know, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 just from that initial investment. And that's really the power of property investment if you do it well.
Well, I think that's a great point because in my mind, property investment is a high growth, relatively low yield investment. So again, that comes back to what your strategy and what your plan is, because it depends upon what your surplus cash flow is. But in general, those who've chased cash flow positive properties or properties with a more cash flow have to forego capital growth. So if you want to become wealthy in property, owning one or two properties isn't enough. I don't know what the rules are going to be when people who are now wanting to take your and my advice are going to be moving forward. I don't know what their time frame is, 20, 30, 40 years to retire, or for some people only 5. All I know is if they have a large asset base, they will have choices. And if they don't have a big asset base, they won't. I don't know whether the rules are going to allow them to borrow, to take money from their super fund, whether they're still going to be able to negatively gear 10, 15 years down the track. But my recommendation is over the future, build an asset base. And it probably shouldn't only be in property because property isn't just cash flow, isn't as strong for cash flow, I should say. So therefore, I believe you should have some money in super. You've got no choice. And there's definitely room for a share portfolio. I'm not sure about Bitcoin, though. That's not an investment for me, even though both my sons are having fun with Bitcoin. But in my mind, that's speculation, Pete.
Yeah, I guess that's more sort of legalized gambling of a sort rather than investing. One of the interesting concepts I remember reading, this would be maybe 25 years ago, about the concept of cheap today is cheap tomorrow. And I think at various points in my property journey, I only had a low borrowing capacity or budget. So I bought in some cheaper locations and they've done just fine, you know, places like Geelong and so on. One of the interesting aspects about an inflationary economy, I guess property in Sydney feels expensive, but I mean, when you look at the properties you own there, you're always happy that you've got properties in cities like London and Sydney and Melbourne because they're always worth a lot in today's dollars. They're very, very good inflation hedges.
Don't expect investment grade returns from secondary properties. It just doesn't work that way. And we all have a limit. So if all you can own is 3 or 4 properties, own the best properties you can. So back to your question, well, what would you buy? If you can afford a house, obviously the extra land value and the higher land to asset ratio, a house would make sense. But if you choose to invest in Melbourne or Sydney, a lot of people aren't going to be able to afford a house in those better suburbs. I would rather own an apartment in a good suburb, but not any apartment, not a high-rise apartment, a family-friendly apartment in a good neighbourhood in Melbourne or Sydney than house and land way out or a property in Darwin or Northern Territory or Alice Springs. So apartments make great investments in Sydney. And so If you said to me, well, if I've got $1 million, what would I buy? You're priced out of a home, so an apartment, and you're probably no longer even in the eastern suburbs, but you're talking about the inner west for an apartment in Sydney. In Melbourne, villa units, which were built in the 60s and 70s as retirement downsizing homes for the older people, they're different to apartments because they don't have somebody above you or behind you or below you. What that is basically an apartment on a block of land with a small front yard and a little courtyard at the back. They make great investments, Pete, because young families want them. They like the security of being on the ground floor. They can take their prams in and out or their shopping in and out. So they're competed, a lot of competition for villa units in Melbourne and in the southeastern suburbs, in the inner western suburbs. You can definitely get a great villa unit in Melbourne for well under $1 million, or even a townhouse. I believe moving forward, townhouses are going to be great investments. So I guess the word townhouse is a British concept, isn't it? Where the landed gentry would have this little house in town, apart from their big property in the country. But in Australia, we're really talking about modern, usually two-story accommodation on a compact block. I can see that being a preferred style of accommodation moving forward, Pete.
Yes, I think so, particularly in the mature capital cities anyway. Yeah, it's interesting. The concept of townhouse, it conjures up this five-bedroom place in Mayfair on five or six different levels and so on. In Australia, we tend to think of a townhouse as, you know, three-bedroom, two-bathroom, maybe two lock-up parking. Suburbs that would be good to own a townhouse in my neck of the woods, in places like New Farm in Brisbane, because they just don't build new ones. There's no space. They can build new apartment towers in the CBD, but there's just nowhere to build new townhouses. And they're family friendly, particularly if you've got a young, you know, baby or something. We lived in a townhouse ourselves in New Farm, and they're really scarce. And an interesting insight there into the villa unit concept. I've just got the one villa unit in my portfolio in Victoria. And I think there's some analogies there with the bungalows in the UK. I think only about 10% of the housing stock in the United Kingdom is the single-story bungalow. But the demand for it has just increased and increased because so many retirees now, as the population ages, they just don't build them. So, and I think the villa unit's a bit the same for young families. If they can't afford a weatherboard home on a quarter acre block or 400 or 500 square meters, well, a villa unit is a pretty good substitute, and they just don't build them.
They don't build them. They can't build them. Because what they did then in the 60s and 70s was they'd pull down large houses on substantial blocks of land and often build three or four and sometimes six villa units, a driveway down the middle and three on either side, or a driveway down one side and four villa units. I've got a number of blocks of those where in the old days I could actually get a whole block from somebody who owned them all. You just can't do that anymore. Apartments are not performing as well in Melbourne at the moment. I think there's going to be a catch-up of apartments because the gap between apartments and houses has never been as big. And as houses are now becoming less affordable, family-friendly apartments, larger apartments, ones with balconies, or particularly ground floor ones with courtyards, they will still make good investments. But I think in Sydney, apartments make great investments, but not in Brisbane. Brisbane really hasn't embraced apartment living as much, have they?
Yeah, there's a lot of overbuilding in particularly the inner city of Brisbane. And in fact, pretty much a whole new suburb went in at Newstead, quite a bit going on at Hamilton down on the river. So yeah, it depends again on the type of property. I think if you're going to buy an apartment, I mean, the things I would always try and look for, try and find a point of scarcity, particularly the more boutique blocks. If you've got a view, that tends to be good. And, you know, proximity to the right kind of locations where they just don't get massively overbuilt, because there's definitely been some of that in recent years.
Interestingly, I happened to, for the first time in 2 years, visit our Sydney office 2 days ago, and I was asking the buyer's agents what they'd bought there, and they'd found a great apartment with an ensuite. You didn't actually walk straight into the living area, but there was a little hallway. It actually had the bedrooms not off the main living area, but off corridors, so that there was some quietness and some amenity, and it had a nice balcony. So that was different. That's what I'd call a family-friendly apartment. That's what I'd call one that's going to always rent easily, let easily. Obviously, there was a lot of competition to buy it. We managed to snare it prior to auction, and our client, I'm sure, is going to have a great investment there. So in Brisbane, though, I'd be buying houses. I'd be buying nowhere near as far out from the CBD as we would in Melbourne or Sydney. So Brisbane, I'd be looking for good transport. Public transport's obviously very important. And with any of these properties, I'd be looking for ones where there is still some ability to do things up and some upside potential rather than something that's been just totally refurbished by somebody else. You don't always have to do the renovation. So I wouldn't necessarily spend the money doing the kitchens and bathrooms and upgrading it straight away. I'd rather buy the best property I can. The renovation potential will always be there to do something, I don't know, in 5 or 10 years' time.
Yeah, I think Brisbane, it's always struck me as a great place to, if you've got the budget to buy properties, you're effectively land banking because there's a lot of really bad housing stock in Brisbane. If you can get something that's good enough to rent out today to a young family or young professionals, maybe for a 3 or 4% yield, but if it's got that potential to do something to it down the track, maybe raise it up and turn it into a 5-bed executive home, or maybe, as you said, just a renovation to the interior. I think a lot of those Queenslander weatherboard properties, the older dated stock that's got potential to do improvements down the track, sort of equity on ice, if you like, you're effectively land banking for the future. I think they've been tremendously good investments. And I know your colleague Brett Warren very well has bought loads of stuff around places like Kedron and Wavell Heights and Stafford and those kind of areas over the years. And hasn't that strategy paid dividends for your clients over the past decade?
Very much so. We just recently bought a property in Brisbane with a really, really poor house on it. People were getting $150 a week rent, so you can imagine how good the property is. But we're going to pull it down, and I've already got plans to build 2 separate homes on it. So I'm not only taking advantage of the rise in the market, but also I'm going to manufacture capital growth.
I think actually it's an interesting point to add there, why having a local expert buyer's agent is important in a market like Brisbane. Because if you're not familiar, I mean, just one strategy that springs to mind, sometimes you've got blocks there that are subdividable, but if you don't know the zoning rules, you wouldn't know that. So if you've got the proximity to commercial property or transport links, sometimes blocks are subdividable and the sellers don't even know it, particularly in some of those suburbs on the north side. And that's where people like Brett Warren and others have, you know, they've stolen an edge on the market for clients over the years because not everybody is fully informed.
So what we're doing is sending clients who've got anywhere between 700 and 1.3, 1.5 to Brisbane because they can get those properties with the upside potential, while in Melbourne they're just buying a villa unit or a townhouse, or in Sydney they're only buying a double garage.
Yeah, it depends as well, as you said, you know, on the personal circumstances. And I guess people should always try and begin with the end in mind. You know, what's the goal? How much borrowing capacity do you have? And where do you have existing assets and exposure? So finally, just give us some local Melbourne insight, because I come down to Melbourne a lot for work and to watch the cricket mainly. But I'm not really anything like an expert in the local market. So where would you invest if you were looking in Melbourne today?
Well, again, it depends what your budget is and what your aim is. We have classically invested in the southeastern suburbs because in Melbourne there is a big difference, demographic difference and social difference between the east and the west. People in the east and southeast suburbs rarely want to go across and live in the western suburbs, but people from the western suburbs want to live in the southeast. Now, it's not a judge of people. There are some really nice gentrifying areas in the inner north and inner western areas. And so it really depends upon budget. But we love going down the bayside areas of Melbourne. So if you can afford the Elwoods or St Kilda's, apartments are good, Brighton's and Hampton's and Sandringham, villa units, or Caulfield, Elstonwick, those affluent areas there. In Melbourne, public transport is very important. Our road system isn't very good, Pete. So if you're in certain locations, trams, which in some states they sort of call light rails, we've kept the trams. And being able to hop on a tram to go to town, or being able to have kids to hop on the tram to go to school, is actually very valuable. And if not, the proximity to train stations as well makes a difference. Not too close, of course. And what's totally changed since COVID is the importance of having a nice neighbourhood. So if you're not right on, but close to where there's some good restaurants, some good shops, some good gyms, and recreation, outdoor areas have become very important as well. And there's a lot of green belts along the southeastern corridor, near Southland, the shopping centre, the big shopping centre there, Cheltenham, Hyatt, Mentone, Parkdale are suburbs that have all gentrified. And as they are, as the old houses are being pulled down and people are building townhouses there and avoid the big apartments in those areas, they're great investment locations as well.
Yes, I certainly get plenty of experience of the traffic every time I arrive at the Tullamarine and sit in traffic for an hour on the way to Melbourne. But exactly as you said, I remember staying in Coburg years and years ago, and the proximity to the tram line was fabulous. Just hop on, be in the city fairly quickly from where we were staying there, just near Coburg. So I think, well, Michael, we could talk all day. We've had amazing insights there from your accumulated 50 years of property market knowledge, particularly in Melbourne and also really in Australia's major capital cities, full stop. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, as I explained at the beginning of the show, this was an episode of Pete Borden's Property Pod podcast, but I hope you got some benefit from our discussion. And as you know, Pete's a regular on my podcast anyway, and we're both big picture people and happy to share our knowledge with as wide an audience as possible. There's another bit of knowledge I'd like to share with you, and that's how you can take advantage of our property markets moving forward. I guess one way is to subscribe to this podcast if you already don't, or subscribe to my property update newsletter, which last year alone had 2.6 million unique readers. Go to propertyupdate.com.au and you'll get commentary from a whole range of property experts. But you can also get my team at Metropol on your side to help you, because as the markets move forward, clearly a rising tide's not going to lift all ships. Some areas are going to outperform others, some areas are going to languish. We don't want you to get caught in the landmines. And my team of experienced property strategists have been through these cycles before. By the way, we don't sell property, but we have a wealth advisory, a financial planning, a property arm, buyer's agency, renovations, development, business mastery as well. So why not go to metropol.com.au, find out a bit about our range of services, leave your details, and let's see how we can make this next year a great year for you in property. We will start by putting a plan together for you, but we first of all got to find out a lot more about you. So metropol.com.au, and let us help you along your journey. Now, I'll be back again real soon. Over the summer period, we're going to be having three shows each week rather than normal two, a new show each week, as well as what I call the summer series, where we bring back some of the best episodes, because we've done close to 400 episodes of the Michael Yardney podcast, and there's a whole lot of gold there. In the meantime, if you want to catch me, look for Michael Yardney on social media, or go to Facebook and join my private Facebook group. Go to the Property Update Facebook group. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropol, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropol to help you?